Okay, well, I mean, I'm going to be crying for a bit of time now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Peter's Field Hospital, the official podcast for the website wherepeteris.com. I'm your host, Mike Lewis. I'm the managing editor of Where Peter Is, and today I am joined with Dan Amiri. Our guest today is Christopher Lamb, the author of the new book, The Outsider, Pope Francis and His Battle to Reform the Church, published by Orbis Books. Christopher is the Rome correspondent for The Tablet and a regular contributor to other outlets, including the BBC. He has covered Pope Francis and the Vatican for the last 5 years. Christopher is married and the father of 3 children. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Mike and Dan, for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you on, Christopher. I just finished the book recently, and I have to say, I really appreciate it. It's a really great look at Pope Francis' papacy, you know, kind of the momentous events that affected him and what he's been involved in over his papacy. And well, I have to say, first of all, it's really well researched and I really appreciate all the work. My first question really is sort of what prompted you to write the book? What really drove you and what gave you passion to do all the work to get this across the finish line?
Well, look, I moved to Rome with my family to cover the Francis papacy. And I was there in St. Peter's Square when the Pope appeared on the balcony for the first time. And I really wanted to document what I felt was the story of the Francis pontificate and to bring together all the articles and other content that I've produced over the years covering it. And it's a book kind of from the heart to tell the story of what I think Pope Francis is doing in terms of leading the church. It's not the kind of magnum opus definitive account. It's my story, it's my account, and I hope that it will help ordinary Catholics who want to perhaps learn a little more about the kind of battle that the Pope has had to go through and is going through to reform the church, and also hopefully non-Catholics, those outside the church.
Chris, one of the things that really appealed to me about this book was the fact that it presents a comprehensive overview of all the resistance that Pope Francis has faced, whether in the media or from bishops or from well-financed political figures. What was it that inspired you to speak about those topics specifically?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, I took that approach really from a journalistic position to say, look, what is the real story of this pontificate? Now, a lot of people have tried to present the Francis papacy as, you know, on the one hand, you've got all the people who love Pope Francis. On the other hand, you've got people who don't like him, as if the church is split 50-50. And my view is that was not correct. I mean, the majority of Catholics and people outside of the church are inspired by Pope Francis, and they think he is the best asset the church has, or one of the best assets the church has in rebuilding the credibility of the church in many parts of the world. So my view was that, why is it that a prophetic reformer pope, a man, you know, clearly of integrity, committed to the gospel, why is he facing so much opposition? I mean, he's also a disruptor pope. He's someone who's tried who loved to say, you know, we shouldn't do things just because they've always been done that way. So I wanted to look at the kind of opposition he faced, because I felt that was the story. You know, that here is a pope, universally loved, respected by ordinary Catholics, yet amongst a number of people in powerful positions, they've tried to thwart the pontificate. I felt that was an important story that was worth raising up and trying to show, rather than this idea that somehow, you know, 50% are in favor and 50% against, which I just don't think is true.
Christopher, I had a question about that because, you know, reading the book, you do talk about that, sort of stood out to me. You talk about Pope Francis being our greatest asset, and the perception that I have being in America, maybe just consuming the media that I'm exposed to, is that that's not what people believe generally, or that's just the sense that I get from a lot of people that have influence. But in your perspective, you and the people you talk to, you think that is more of a widespread view, that Pope Francis is an asset?
Well, look, I think if you look at the context with which Francis was elected, it was a very difficult moment for the Vatican in particular, and you've had the clerical sex abuse scandals battering the reputation of the church, also problems with Vatican finances, a general sense that the leadership of the church at the center was kind of rudderless. Now, I'm not criticizing Benedict XVI here, but he himself felt unable to continue to lead the church. That's why he resigned. And there's a general sense of crisis. And the reason why I say that the Pope is the greatest asset, I say that in terms of leadership. You know, as Catholics, we look to the Pope for that. And I think that in the context with which he was elected, which was a very difficult time, here was a Pope who called himself after St. Francis of Assisi, who immediately showed that he was going to be wanted to serve the marginalized, the poorest, who wanted an authentic kind of leadership. I feel that is a huge asset for the church. And it's just fascinating that there are so many people in high levels who don't necessarily feel like that. I'm not saying that Pope Francis is perfect. He's made a number of mistakes. There have been issues and problems. But I think fundamentally, if you look to a Christian leader, you want someone of personal integrity and who wants to imbue the office of the papacy with the values of the gospel. I think that is something that is what the church needs.
One of the things that, and I think this is what Dan was referring to, is that especially in the United States, and it's possibly the case in the UK as well among Catholics, is that for many Catholics, the presentation or the depiction of Pope Francis that they receive is almost entirely negative, or is critical, or is concerned. There's at the very least, a little bit of nervousness. On the other hand, some stories seem especially tailored to portray him in a negative light. Now, as a Vatican correspondent, you sat there in the Vatican press office with a lot of the journalists who are propagating this view. What do you think is behind that? What do you think motivates that?
Yeah, look, I completely see your point, except that a lot of the framing of the Francis Pontificate is particularly in the English-speaking Catholic world, has tried to skew it in a negative direction. They say, oh, this Pope, you know, he's not very papal because he's not living in the Apostolic Palace. He speaks off the cuff. He's changing doctrine. He's not really interested in reforming things. He's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think my impression is that some of the media coverage has been skewed, and I think the it's part of the world that we're living in, you know, with social media and the rise of fake news and et cetera. And there is a tendency to move away from the kind of clear, objective reporting and into that sort of ideological narrative. And I think that is what has gone on here. There has been a kind of, I say, a Fox Newsification of the Catholic media world, a Breitbartization of it, where you kind of push a line all the time and you don't put the full picture out there.
I had a question about your experience working alongside other journalists, Christopher. I mean, I think in the epilogue, you talk about how there were some times where maybe things got a little heated, or just by being there from the tablet. I mean, what, in general terms, you know, your experience working alongside other journalists, do you feel like You had a good working relationship generally?
Yes, I think there's a very good collegial relationship with journalists covering the Vatican in general. And you know, on the whole, people get on, and that's all to the good. I mean, the point I make in the book is what happened particularly around the Amazon Synod, when there was a misrepresentation of some of the indigenous symbols that were used during the Amazon Synod and around the Amazon Synod, and I felt that that was not really journalism. That was more advocacy rather than reporting on what was going on, and there was some misrepresentation. I did decide to make an apology to some of the indigenous people in the Amazon for what I saw was some kind of xenophobic commentary from within some parts of the Catholic media. And then I was, as I put in my book, I was confronted by someone from another media outlet. So about that, to complain about what I'd said. The point I'm making in general is that during the Amazon Synod, the tensions were very high. There was a real battle going on. And of course, we saw with the Pachamama statues or the Our Lady of the Amazon statues, which were then thrown into the river. I mean, this was kind of an extraordinary drama. And I think you got a sense of the church as being a spiritual battleground during that time. I think, look, of course, everyone in the media have their biases and their positions, and no one's totally objective. But I think that when, as an organization, media organization in the Catholic world, you decide to set yourself in kind of opposition to the Pope, I think you need to level with your audience about that editorially and tell people that's your position and explain why that position is, not to kind of go around just constantly reporting in a certain way that is not necessarily transparent to people about what your intentions are. I mean, just to give you a quick thing on the tablet, I mean, the tablet was in the past, under other pontificates, John Paul II and Benedict XVI, accused of being too progressive, too liberal, too critical. And of course, there were times when the tablet was critical of those pontificates and the decisions that were made. But I think it was always, they sought to couch it within the tradition and within church teaching. What we've seen under Francis is a kind of, I'd say, a guerrilla warfare, you know, particularly with the Archbishop Vigano letter or statement, which called on the Pope to resign, that was published with a litany of accusations in full on certain media outlets. And you just wonder, you know, is there reporting going on here or is it advocacy?
And that kind of leads into my other question. Catholics in the media, I feel like they often have this natural tension. You know, do you express loyalty to the Pope or do you do your job in trying to uncover the facts? And obviously you would hope that they would be aligned, but oftentimes you get into that sort of advocacy position where you feel like just by presenting the facts, you're taking a side. And so in general terms, like, how would you describe the role of the Catholic media and how do you see yourself? How do you try to be a Catholic journalist?
Well, that's a great question. And I think it kind of cuts to the core of what I try to do. And like I've said that, you know, I'm a journalist first and a Catholic second. That doesn't mean that my faith isn't central to who I am and my life. But we need to do the journalism right. We need to do the journalism and the reporting well in order for it to be effective in terms of the church and in terms of what it does in service to the church or for the church. And I think that there is a role of media ministry in a sense. It's about trying to explain what is going on, trying to give good information, to check facts, to be reliable, but also to tell the story in a compelling way, to engage with people, not just to be preaching to the converted, but actually trying to get the message out to as wide an audience as possible. So that's how I see my role, to do the journalism well, but within the context, obviously, of the church and trying to make the truths of the faith better understood. And I think that's part of what we're doing. And also, I'm operating as a Catholic journalist in, in an increasingly secularized world, particularly in Europe, where religious illiteracy is on the rise. And I think it's more important than ever that we have good, informative, accurate reporting that engages audiences, some of whom really don't have much understanding of what the Christian faith is.
Christopher, one of the things that has jumped out to me, and one of the reasons why I started Where Peter Is, and I have a feeling that part of it motivated writing your book, people in the past who support Pope Francis had told me, said things to us like, you should ignore them. That's the fringe. Not many people, no one's listening to them. Why are you drawing attention to them? And while in a lot of ways they do have a point, I've noticed that they are actually making an impact on the real world. Not only are a number of Catholics being persuaded by their usual media outlets like EWTN or Ignatius Press Books or First Things, but it's actually having real impact adversely on this papacy. In your book, you give a litany of 100 either coordinated or highly publicized public challenges or attacks on Pope Francis. And a lot of times these specific attacks actually impacted the way that the church governed or proved to be a real disruption to the papacy. I'm thinking of when the Vigano testimony was released in the middle of a highly pressurized visit to Ireland, for example, by the Pope, and he had to address it on the plane. What do you think the goal of all of these attacks on Francis have been? And what do you think has prompted them? It seems to be that they are actively trying to disrupt the papacy. Am I inaccurate in saying that?
Yeah, I think they are trying to disrupt it, and they're trying to thwart some of the reforms in the direction of the pontificate of Francis. And I think you've got to see sort of two sides of the opposition. There's the theological opposition that exists amongst people who feel that Francis is somehow breaking with doctrine and therefore is very dangerous, etc. And then you have what I call the politicized opposition, which is the opposition from places like, you know, there's a political opposition which we've seen with from Trump to Salvini and to Catholics who have allied themselves with those political forces, and I think they see Francis as a threat to their worldview. They don't like a Pope who focuses relentlessly on the poor and on refugees, who wants to talk about climate change, who wants to talk about the unfair economic system. They don't like a Pope who does that, and they also are concerned about a papacy that hasn't run to their agenda. I mean, Francis said very early on that it wasn't going to be, he didn't want the church to just be about certain moral teachings. He wanted a different agenda. And I think if you've based your kind of professional Catholic life on certain priorities and certain defending certain doctrines, to have a Pope who actually says, no, we're not going to do that anymore, then that is a threat. And the other thing I point out in the book is, particularly from the wealthy donors to Catholic causes, of course, some of the wealthy donors in the US have cut off funding to the Vatican. A lot of that is down to lack of access and to not being able to get in to see the Pope. You know, under the previous pontificates, if you were a wealthy donor, you could get in to see the Pope in an early morning mass, and that's no longer accessible. And so I think that is where a lot of the opposition has come from. I think it is politicized as well as being theological.
Christopher, that kind of leads into a question I had here. I mean, following Pope Francis a little bit, early on in this papacy, I guess I was finding that you had a lot of these figures that found themselves close to Francis. Like you mentioned in this book, like he likes to keep his friends close and his enemies closer. So you have maybe Cardinal Serra and Mueller, people who might be ideologically opposed to Francis, but have still remained within this fold, if you will. But then Mueller gets let go. You know, after his 5 years, he resigns and he goes off and does his thing. But then he almost instantly turns into this anti-Francis advocate, and he gets caught up in all the controversies. I mean, to me, it seems I kind of struggle. Like, is this something that, you know, people are being manipulated into being opposed to him? Or is this something like you kind of referring to before? Is it just an ideological difference and they just take issue with him? I mean, how entrenched are these powers that are so opposed to Francis?
I think in Rome and the Vatican, there are powers who are pretty entrenched against him. And that's where there's a kind of, what we call the silent opposition. You know, the people who won't necessarily show their face to oppose, but they will be opposing behind the scenes. So, I mean, I suppose you could see that the Amazon Synod, you know, the opposition to any change on allowing married men to be ordained priests in the Amazon, that was really from the Roman Curia. Of course, that synod was all about the Amazon, and it was the Amazon bishops who came, and they all voted en masse to say, look, we need priests or married men as priests to help serve remote communities. But the opposition was from the Curia. Similarly on the female deacons, etc. So there is a body of people within the Vatican, I think, in the Curia, who are opposed. Not a huge amount, but a significant body there. You mentioned Cardinal Mueller, and I think that's an interesting case, because when he was prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, he was openly loyal to Francis and sought to defend the teaching. But then as soon as he lost his position, he went down the opposition route. And so you can't help but draw the conclusion that maybe that's because he lost his position abruptly. Cardinal Mueller also tried to present himself as the kind of theological guardian to the Francis pontificate, because Mueller said that Francis was not a theologian and therefore needed a theologian such as Cardinal Mueller to help him. And that was seen as a kind of, you know, we could say a slightly unusual way of looking at the cardinal's role, given that it was only up until 50 or so years ago, 60 years ago, that the Pope himself was not in charge of that department. So the idea that the Pope needed a theologian to help him was kind of gave you an insight into how people in Rome saw Francis. They see him as kind of, he doesn't have enough theological understanding to do the job. And it's a kind of patronizing view, really, because, you know, they say, oh, well, he's from Latin America. He doesn't really understand theology like we do. So you can see that going on within the Vatican and in Rome. And I think it's kind of multi-layered. Like I've said, in Rome, doctrine can equal power. Defending doctrine can be about defending your position as much as it being about a theological or genuine theological debate.
Yes, this is what you said about Cardinal Mueller, especially during his time as prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. One of the things that struck me, and based on some of the stories that I've read and reports about his time in that role, even though he remained the functional head of that office, it seemed that there was a bit of a disconnect between him and the papacy. For example, his defenses of Amoris Laetitia didn't precisely line up with the Buenos Aires guidelines or what the document itself said. Obviously, while he was still in the role, he was very vocally supportive, but there weren't a ton of documents coming out from the CDF. I mean, as soon as Cardinal Ladaria took over the role, I think they've put out 6 or 7 documents in a very short period of time on some very significant topics. I wonder, not speaking specifically about Cardinal Mueller, but if there is an intellectual disconnect between his theological critics and his papacy and those who support him. We get peppered with the same questions and the same talking points over and over and over again at where Peter is and on Twitter. And it seems to me that there's something that just isn't clicking with people. Is this something that you've observed as well? Do you think it's an honest misunderstanding, or do you think that there's something a little bit more intentional behind it?
I think you're getting to kind of the heart of the matter here. I mean, you often hear sometimes people arguing from a theological position, saying, "Oh, I don't agree with what the Pope did, etc., etc." But then when you dig down, it's more than that. It's sometimes a kind of just a general sense that they have a problem with this Pope, which they can't necessarily put their finger on, and it's dressed up in a theological dispute. So I think there is something there. I don't think we've kind of necessarily got to the bottom of what that is, but it's almost like somehow this Pope doesn't speak to me or for me, and therefore I must present theological problems with what he's doing. And I do think a lot of that goes back to these early morning masses that the Pope has in Santa Marta, which are now being live streamed all over the world because of the COVID-19 crisis. But in those masses, the Pope each morning gives his kind of freewheeling homily on the gospel of the day, and he can be very tough on the church in those homilies. He interprets the gospel, applies the gospel stories to the church, and some people don't like that. I mean, he talked about rigid Catholics, he's talked about the modern day doctors of the law, and there are a lot of people who find that very challenging and unsettling. I would argue that the Pope challenges all Catholics, whether they're on the more conservative spectrum or the more liberal spectrum. And I actually put in the book, there's actually quite a lot of opposition to him from the left of the church as well as the right. So I think those early morning Santa Marta homilies where he speaks off the cuff, they really challenge people. And I think some people find it hard to be challenged in their faith. But that is what the Pope is doing. And I think that's why I've described him as a disruptor Pope. And I think that might be where some of these issues that you're talking about come into play. I should just say there's a funny story, as I write in the book, about when the Pope had a meeting of officials from the Roman Curia, and he said to them at the end, as he always says, it was early on in his pontificate, he said, please pray for me. And they replied, one of them replied, we pray for you, Holy Father, especially when you speak off the cuff.
Christopher, recently we had this book supposedly co-authored by Cardinal Sarah and the Pope Emeritus Benedict. And that was a topic that I didn't see in your book. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts. It seemed to fit nicely in with some of the figures you mentioned, Nicholas Diat and obviously Cardinal Sarah, and the sort of Catholic media interest here in America especially. And I was wondering if you could kind of comment on that, or maybe in a future version of this book you had some more topics and this will be one of them.
Yeah, unfortunately the book had to be sent off before the Cardinal Sarah book came out, so I wasn't able to address that in the book. But I do talk about the role of Cardinal Sarah in the book and what role he's played. And obviously he's someone who has seems to have challenged Francis on the liturgy side of things, and Francis has corrected Cardinal Sarah on a number of occasions. I think that, as I put in the book, there are people who are trying to create these kind of parallel authorities, parallel papacies. So they're sort of presenting alternative visions of leadership, you know, going back to the good old days. And I think that's a little bit of what's happened with Cardinal Sarah, who I should point out has got an incredible backstory, which I write about in the book, who led the church in Guinea under dictatorships and then came to Rome and now has got this role within the church, particularly amongst people who are not so keen on Francis, as this kind of alternative leader. And he has got support in the US. I write about how the Knights of Columbus bought up copies of his book to distribute. So he has got these kind of supporters. And Nicholas Diat, who helps with all the writing of the books, is the kind of man who is working behind the scenes, the eminence grise, as they might in traditional term for that. So, yeah, I think Cardinal Sarah is he's not someone who's openly trying to attack Francis, etc. He's doing something a little bit different. I tried to explore that in the book. And of course, the Cardinal's book with Benedict XVI on clerical celibacy and all the drama around that showed it was clearly an attempt to try and tie the Pope's hands on the Amazon Synod. And that, I think, is why the opposition does matter, because whilst any ordinary Catholics will say, well, of course, you know, the Pope can change whatever he wants. He can get on, he can do whatever he wants. Well, actually, it's much more complicated than that. Francis has to work within a system where he has got a lot of opposition, and that does constrict in some ways and make life quite difficult. So, and I suppose it's interesting that the high up you get in the clerical or church establishment, the more you find the opposition to Francis, which I think is quite interesting.
Chris, speaking of leaders that are high up in the hierarchy and who are establishing alternative magisteria to what Pope Francis has been teaching, your book touches a little bit on Cardinal Raymond Burke, who seems to have his hand in almost every movement that's associated with resistance to Pope Francis, whether it's EWTN or the Napa Institute or pretty much any organization that seems to have some kind of theological opposition to Francis. What your book doesn't go in depth into Cardinal Burke, which I commend you for staying your hand. But what do you think his role is in this? For one thing, I think that because of his willingness to sign on to these various initiatives, a lot of which are open letters that are presented to the media or to grant interviews where he says explicitly that a certain magisterial act it has no authority, by being a cardinal, that lends credence to those positions. Do you have any thoughts on his role?
I think Cardinal Burke within the opposition to Francis, clearly he has played a leading public role. He's the most obvious conservative traditionalist opponent who goes public to raise his concerns. And I would say to give credit to Cardinal Burke, he does actually make his case in public, and he actually tries to say what he says, what he thinks. He doesn't hide behind anything or anyone, which I think is to his credit. But I would say that he has been at the forefront of the what I would call the theological doctrinal attacks on Francis, this claim that somehow the Pope is not really teaching Catholic doctrine in the correct way, or somehow breaking with Catholic doctrine. He's been really involved in all that, particularly with this with the dubia over Amoris Laetitia. So I think that he's been at the center of resistance from the word go, as I put in the book. I mean, during the Synod on the Family, the two Synods on the Family, he was dead against any shift on communion for divorced and remarried, and has been ever since. I would say my observation is that he clearly has a constituency within the church. He has a following, big following, and they expect him to lead them, and they actually expect him, I sensed, to speak out against Francis. And my feeling is with Cardinal Burke is that he does have to kind of keep his constituency happy. And I think part of keeping the constituency happy is to call into question some of the things the Pope is doing. And I think there is a well-funded lobby behind him. He is
part of that, and that lobby is pretty hostile to what Francis is doing. Interestingly, Francis, although he removed him from the head of the Apostolic Signatura and made him effectively powerless within the Order of Malta, although he made those moves against him, he gave him a role as a consultant to the Apostolic Signatura, and he also got him to investigate a canonical case of abuse in Guam. So the Pope has actually tried to keep Cardinal Burke within the tent. And that's one of the things that's characteristic of Francis is that he doesn't take on the opposition in a confrontational way. He often goes around the edges or tries to keep people on board. And I think that's a genuine intention of Francis to try and keep the church together, try and keep the different factions in all within a sense of unity. So I just think he's not doing that purely for kind of strategic reasons. He's doing it because I think he genuinely wants to have different voices within the church.
When you said you don't think that it's strategic on Francis's part, I believe that's absolutely true. I think my own personal opinion, and I've written about this, is that Francis is sacrificing what might be a better outcome in not giving any kind of ecclesial cover to these movements by generously allowing these people, prelates that are in open opposition, to maintain their title. Very early in the SSPX movement, Pope Paul VI suspended the faculties of Archbishop Lefebvre. And since then, the SSPX has remained tiny. But I think out of concern for Cardinal Burke himself, because I personally would expect that if canonical action was taken against him, that he would continue his crusade, whether it took him outside the church or not. I think Francis, out of concern for Cardinal Burke himself, has allowed him to remain a cardinal. This is just my speculation. I don't know if you have a sense of that, but I think it would be much more, if we look in terms of outcome, he would lose a lot of clout. One of the arguments that's used against our arguments against Burke at Where Peter Is, people will say, well, he's a cardinal in good standing. Why shouldn't Archbishop Chaput invite him to his cathedral? Why shouldn't Raymond DeRoyo ask him for his opinion on this magisterial document? He's a cardinal in good standing. Pope Francis clearly doesn't disagree with him. Do you get that sense as well?
Yeah, I think the Pope doesn't want to go after his opponents or to discipline or sanction everyone who criticizes him or is not in agreement. And I think he genuinely will have as Pope, as an instrument of unity in the church, as the center of unity in the church, he will be wanting to ensure that the cardinal remains within it and not to try and alienate or exclude him. And that's why I think he's given him those roles, advisory roles that I mentioned earlier. The Pope has talked about allowing people to retire and not replacing them. He's talked about not taking on the opposition in a full frontal way. And I think that's part of the approach with Cardinal Burke. He's not going to try and make a martyr out of someone who disagrees with him. I mean, the Pope has also talked about criticism being healthy, and I think there is that's an important point. I think that criticism is a healthy thing to have within the church, and no one is above criticism. But what he said was less helpful was the kind of under the table knifing that went on and the toxic attacks. And I think that's what my book tries to look at. I'm not saying that Francis shouldn't be criticized. What I'm saying is that there have been these attacks which don't seem to be about criticism. They seem to be about genuine attempts to bring down the pontificate.
I was hoping that, before we let you you go. There was one more thing I was hoping you could comment on, both from your own perspective and also in terms of everything we've been talking about here, which was the extraordinary Urbi et Orbi just recently. And obviously it was notable just in terms of our own Pope and sort of the approach that we have, or as Pope Francis as a pastor. But I felt that it was also notable in the sense that all of these detractors that you would look to found themselves applauding Pope Francis. And I don't know if you could just comment on that moment in particular. Was this, should we expect more of the same, I guess, or should we expect sort of, is this a change in tone from the opposition, or was this just an extraordinary event?
Well, I think you've hit on something important there. I think the COVID-19 crisis is a real game changer for the church. It's going to have profound implications, I think, in the long term. And what Francis has done is shown himself as a spiritual leader to the world as it goes through a dark night of the soul. And Pope Francis has stepped up. He's in the epicenter of the pandemic. He's 83 and therefore is vulnerable to the coronavirus disease. And I think his Urbi et Orbi blessing and event was Bergoglio at his best. And, the grand gesture, the application of the church's tradition and teaching and gospel and the gospel to a world crisis.
Well, thank you very much to Christopher Lamb, author of the new book, The Outsider, Pope Francis and His Battle to Reform the Church, published by Orbis Books. What should we look to in the future?
Well, I hope to be writing more about the Francis papacy. I hope to maybe write another book. I'm not quite sure yet on what, but I would like to keep writing. I think you can also look out in America for the documentary that I was involved in called Inside the Vatican, which is airing on PBS on April 28th, which gives a kind of insider's take on how the Vatican runs and what the Pope has been doing to reform. So, I'm going to keep going, keep plugging away. It's not an easy time for the media at the moment with the COVID-19 pandemic. We're all shut down, in lockdown. Yeah, I also sense there's never been more demand for what the media does and what journalism, particularly Catholic journalism, is doing. So I'm going to keep going, and please watch this space, as they say.
Thank you very much for your work. And you're also a very busy man. Our listeners maybe heard a baby crying in the background. You are the new father to a little boy named Thomas Francis Arthur Lamb. Lovely name. Lovely middle name. I have two middle names, and the first one is also Francis. So,
Well, thank you very much. He's 9 weeks old, and he's keeping me pretty busy, but reminding me of what's important in life.
Absolutely. This has forced all of us with kids to learn to appreciate them more. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And once again, the book is The Outsider, Pope Francis and His Battle to Reform the Church by Christopher Lamb, published by Orbis Books, available at the publisher website and at Amazon.com. Sorry that all of our questions were about Austin Ivory. So.